Good evening and welcome. I'd like to welcome you to our next presentation, which is being given by Marcy Ray. We use this room in the library for any number of events, and I hope you'll enjoy the presentation and the new technology that was installed last summer. A moment of introduction for Marcy Ray. She is an assistant professor of musicology in the MSU College of Music. She holds a degree in vocal performance from the University of Texas at Austin, and she completed her master's and PhD in musicology at UCLA. Her research interests focus primarily on music, gender, sexuality, and class. Her first book manuscript, entitled The Politics of Love in French Baroque Opera, illustrates how male composers and librettists diminished early feminist literary archetypes when they adapted them for the musical stage. Portions of this research have been published in the journal Musica en Perspectiva and a collection of essays entitled The Libretto as Enlightenment Tool. Another article is forthcoming in Early Music. Tonight's talk forms a part of her second book project on makeover musicals. One aspect of this new research agenda has been published in American Music. Thank you for coming, and thank you, Marcy. We know it's going to be a great speech.
Thank you.
All right, good evening. Thank you so much for being here. I know that I'm competing with Bernie Sanders right now, so I appreciate you being here. Tonight's talk on Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical, The Phantom of the Opera, which premiered in London in 1986 and then in New York in 1988, is part of a book-length study that I'm currently working on regarding the makeover musical. My initial interest in this topic was to investigate how such shows reinvented women in different decades to reveal prevailing trends about what constituted ideal femininity. What I've discovered over the course of this research is that often the most interesting part of the makeover musical is not the woman's transformation, but a man's role in it. When I looked at Alan J. Lerner and Friedrich Lowe's My Fair Lady, I had just as much to say about Professor Henry Higgins as I did about the heroine Eliza. When I looked at Grease, Danny Zuko's static quality as a character seemed to be more revealing than Sandy's metamorphosis from prude to vixen. Likewise, while The Phantom of the Opera does show the progress of its heroine, Christine, from chorus girl to leading lady, this musical tells us much more about masculinity in the late 80s than it does, I think, about femininity. I should note that I'm not just looking at any makeover musicals, but rather I'm invested in stories that refashion two ancient tales from Ovid's Metamorphoses, Pygmalion and Echo and Narcissus. These two stories provide the lens through which I examine each of the musicals in this book project. Thus, it might be worth reviewing them now in case it's been a while since you've read them. Pygmalion is the story of a sculptor who has become so disgusted with contemporary women that he turns to his art to craft his ideal. He carves a beautiful woman out of ivory and then falls in love with her. The artist then lavishes attention and gifts upon his immobile maiden, adorning her with jewelry and fabrics. Eventually, he prays to Venus, the goddess of love, that he might find a woman just like his statue, not quite daring to ask the deity to bring his sculpture to life. When he returns home, he begins to caress his masterpiece, and her skin turns soft and warm to his touch. She comes alive, and they marry. The statue, who only acquired the name Galatea and much later in the myth's history, says nothing at all. We might wonder whether she truly was willing to devote her life to her sculptor. Echo and Narcissus is a related myth, but instead of coming to life, our heroine fades away. Juno has punished the nymph Echo for detaining her with idle chatter when she was hunting down her philandering husband, Jupiter, king of the gods. Juno left the heroine only able to repeat the last words that others have uttered. The tragedy of the situation is made clear when the young nymph Echo falls in love with Narcissus. She is anxious to communicate with him, but can only iterate what he says to himself. He has fallen in love with his own image in a pool of water, seen here, and speaks loving words only to his reflection. Echo, unable to get Narcissus to notice her, wastes away until nothing but her bones and her voice remain. The young man eventually drowns himself as he tries to embrace his watery image. I'm interested in these two stories because they are often fused in 20th century musicals. That is, the male protagonists in musicals, like both Pygmalion and Narcissus, fall in love with images that are like or are projections of themselves, while the women they love have little voice or agency of their own. Tonight, I show how Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical, The Phantom of the Opera, interweaves themes adapted from these two ancient myths. The Phantom fashions himself as a modern-day Pygmalion when he begins to give music lessons to the heroine and control the direction of her life. His aims are narcissistic, however. He hopes to acquire a voice in the world through hers. In the end, he becomes barely an echo of her, revealing perhaps a bleak view of man's future in a world in which women had begun to acquire greater autonomy. Indeed, this talk seeks to illuminate why the Phantom must be physically disfigured, why he wishes to control Christine, and how this musical served as an allegory for broader social, cultural, and political contexts in the 1980s. In particular, this talk uncovers why a reincarnation of the tortured 19th century musical genius resonated with audiences of the 1980s and 90s. It showed that in the aftermath of two decades of second wave feminist assault on straight white masculinity, the Phantom emerges to garner sympathy for men's lost prestige. I historicize the romantic genius archetype and illuminate how it represents a fitting and long-standing refuge for the eccentric Western male. But I also wonder, could Phantom be seen to seek sympathy for male privilege and at the same time critique it? Phantom of the Opera, like all makeover musicals in my book project, seems to reveal much more about masculinity and its historical context than about what constitutes ideal femininity, quite contrary to my expectations when I began this project. Phantom, My Fair Lady, and Grease all have women who transform into what the narrative tells us is a superior version of themselves. But this metamorphosis seems less important than showing us how men make this happen, much like Ovid's tales of Pygmalion and Narcissus. In Phantom, the protagonist attempts to mold the heroine into his ideal singer and in effect brings her to life when she emerges from the chorus to become the star of the show. She represents the projection of his desires, as the statue was for Pygmalion. As in Grease, the heroine's transformation takes but a moment. She moves with relative ease from mute slave dancer in the opera house's production of Grand Opera to the noble prima donna. The transition relies on a number of conventional tropes in opera, but which might have appealed to audiences of the 1980s. Beginning in the 18th century, opera composers began to showcase two leading women. One that was a model of contemporary feminine virtue, and the other to serve as her foil and a warning to ambitious women. In such operas, the composer and libretto show that the modest, self-effacing heroine is the more appropriate mate for the hero, and often the more exciting leading lady suffers destruction or expulsion at the end. The moral is that aggressive women were unmarriageable. And George Friedrich Handel's Rinaldo from 1711, the weepy Almirena ends up with the eponymous Christian crusader. And her rival, the Muslim sorceress Armida, must convert to Christianity and marry an inferior man, a move that presumably chastens her. Over a century later, in Georges Bizet's Carmen, 1875, the acquiescent Micaela hardly compares to the passionate Carmen. But in the end, the hero Don José must murder the latter for refusing to be pinned down by conventional bourgeois mores. This dichotomy is evident in Phantom. We are first introduced to the opera populaire's leading lady, Carlotta Giudicelli, an Italian opera diva. She is fiery and prone to threaten to quit the production if she is not shown proper attention from the managers of the theater. She parades about as the conventional prima donna, complaining about the length of her gown, the unsuitability of her hat, and other grievances. She fusses and grumbles and finally refuses to perform because the opera house's new managers seem more interested in the young dancing girls than in her art.
Signora.
Maestro.
Think of me fondly when we've said goodbye. Remember me once in a while. Please promise me you'll try. When you find that once again you long to take you.
The opera.
Signora, are you all right? Okay, for God's sake, man, what's going on up there?
Please, monsieur, don't look at me. Scott's my judge. I wasn't at my post. Please, monsieur, there's no one there. Or if there is, well then, it must be a ghost.
Signora, these things do happen.
For the past 3 years, these things do happen. And did you stop them from happening? No! And you too, you're as bad as him. These things do happen. Until you stop these things from happening, this thing does not happen. Orlando, andiamo! Bring my doggy and my foxy.
Amateurs.
Left without a leading soprano, the opera managers must find a substitute. Madame Jury, the choreographer, suggests Christine, and immediately we see that she is all that Carlotta is not. She emerges hesitantly, in her slave girl costume, no less, from the chorus to test out the number from the current show. Shyly, she sings Think of Me, and as the opera managers look at her with approval, the scene imagines a Cinderella-like transformation. She transitions from her slave girl attire to a massive white gown with two white steeds behind her. What this establishes very quickly is that Christine is the real leading lady here, one that better exemplifies feminine virtue.
My nerves. She's very pretty.
Think of me fondly when we've said goodbye. Remember me once in a while, please promise me you'll try. When you find that once again you long to take her heart back and be free, if you ever find a moment, spare a thought for me.
Won't think, oh, we won't.
distinction between the two women is emphasized again when the Phantom alerts the managers that he wishes Christine to play the role of the Countess in their upcoming production of Il Muto, demanding that Carlotta should play the mute page boy. Here, the diva's faults are laid bare to encourage the audience to wish for her destruction. To signal her ambition and how it symbolizes male castration, a painting in her dressing room portrays her as Salome with a man's head on a platter. On opening night, when Carlotta dares perform the role of the Countess, the Phantom chastens her aggressive demand for the spotlight by transforming her voice into that of a toad so that she can only croak out her melismas, much to the amusement of the audience, both on stage and off. Phantom is not without its wrinkles in this long-standing approach to creating ideal women. Unlike Ovid's tale, where the woman submits to her creator's embrace at the end, Christine, on the other hand, rejects the Phantom in favor of the young Count, Raoul. Such a rejection was not conventional in makeover tales such as this one, which leads me to explore its meaning in the 1980s. Other movies had previously remade the Pygmalion myth between a male creative genius and his female protege. And George Cukor's 1954 A Star is Born, a young singer, Esther Blodgett, played by Judy Garland, becomes the apprentice of the alcoholic Norman Maine, played by James Mason, a fading celebrity. He eventually drowns himself, suffering from envy over his wife's brilliant career, a kind of narcissistic tale in and of itself. But at the end of the film, as his wife utters the last line, "This is Mrs. Norman Maine," she indicates that her success is inseparable from his influence. In essence, he created her, and she owes her glory to him. This is, of course, the Phantom's wish, but Christine will not sublimate her identity into his. To understand the Phantom's abject position in the musical, we must turn to the historical moment in which he was created. A number of scholars have already noted that 1980s cinema responded to recent challenges to straight white male privilege. Yvonne Tasker, Claudia Spring, and Susan Jeffords have shown that the hyper-masculine male body bolstered by technology in such films as Terminator, RoboCop, Cyborg, and Universal Soldier responded to the crisis of male identity by demonstrating that men could be reborn following second wave feminist attacks on masculinity, improved and impervious to assault. Though the Terminator and RoboCop are destroyed in each movie, there is always the promise that they can be reassembled. Furthermore, technology becomes a metaphor for renewable masculine strength and phallic power. Springer observes that the invincible armored man of steel sought to ward off what was perceived to be the contemporary feminization of culture. Yvonne Tasker argues that the rise of the male bodybuilder types, such as Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger in the 1980s, can also be understood as a backlash against the feminism of the 1970s. Figures such as Rambo operated in an opposite pole to another version of masculinity that appeared in 1980s film, what Judith Williamson and Jonathan Rutherford have called the new man. The latter seem to incorporate aspects of feminism and an idealized, sensitive masculinity, as in such films as Three Men and a Baby. While at the opposite end of the spectrum, tough guys on film asserted a more traditional or even exaggeratedly violent masculine authority. Rutherford explains that a classic example such as Rambo advertises a destructive machismo as the solution to men's problems. He is John Wayne with his gloves off, wildly lashing out at everything that threatens to disappoint him. He confronts a world gone soft, pacified by traitors and cowards, dishonorable, feminized men. In a world that has disrupted his notions of manhood and honor, it threatens his comprehension of who he is. And attempts to recreate order and subdue the forces that threaten him degenerate into a series of violent actions. Tasker notes that these two poles of masculinity appeared at the same historical moment and need to be understood as interacting with and informing each other. She and Barbara Creed argue that contrasting images may also reveal anxiety about what constituted contemporary masculinity. Creed claims that excessively muscular figures are actually a caricature of cultural expectations, what she calls a simulacra of exaggerated masculinity, the original completely lost to sight, a casualty of the failure of the paternal signifier, and the current crisis in master narratives. Lloyd Webber's Phantom may be understood to reconcile these two poles of masculinity, the hyper-masculine and the new man, unlike in the original novel, to become a real romantic rival to Raoul. He wasn't in the original story. This negotiation, however, is fairly messy. His sensitive, loving side is overshadowed by his coercion and homicidal tendencies. The Phantom appeals to some of the virtues of the new man, but when tenderness fails to win Christine's heart, he turns to aggression and even to violence. Both appeals to sensitivity and dominance emphasize the character's overall impotence, offering a critique of both versions of masculinity. The Phantom's song, Music of the Night, is the most direct appeal to the new man, with its tender language, lyrical melody, whispered declamation, and then soaring orchestration that often signals love in movies. His tenor voice moves to its powerful high range to indicate his passion. It could almost be a typical affectionate love song, but it's not without its hint of manipulation. He sings about possessing Christine, and how he hopes that she will surrender to the power of his music. He hopes ultimately to own her through marriage, which is actually a very typical aim for love songs, but here it is baldly presented. The Phantom leads her at the climax of the song to a statue of herself dressed in a wedding gown. It comes off as creepy rather than romantic. Furthermore, the Phantom's effect on the heroine seems more supernatural than like courtship. Christine is shown to be his submissive pupil. She even calls him master in the song Angel of Music. And a 2004 film directed by Joel Schumacher, she approaches him as if in a trance, eyes wide and mouth agape. She sings a more sultry song about how he came to her in her dreams and how he controls her mind. She says, "I'm the mask you wear," to which he replies, "It's me they hear." When at the end of this number, Christine wishes to see the human behind the mask, he rages at her curiosity, calling her tellingly, I think, Pandora, another woman from Ovid's Metamorphosis, a male creation gone wrong. He lashes out, pushing her to the ground, calling her other names that assault her virtue, such as Delilah and Viper, which is calling up the biblical reference to Eve. And as when Toto pulls back the curtain to reveal the Wizard of Oz is just an old man, when Christine unmasks the Phantom, we find that he is weak underneath. To recuperate his stature in her eyes and to play on her sympathy, he describes himself as a gargoyle that burns in hell but yearns for heaven. He promises that she'll learn to see the man behind the monster, much like the fairy tale Beauty and the Beast. He's self-deprecating, calls himself a repulsive carcass, while he dreams of beauty. The music softens here, and she reaches out to him, offering his mask back. She later claims that in his eyes, she saw all the sadness of the world. We are asked to sympathize with his suffering emblematized in his disfigured face, even though it is but a physical manifestation of his psychological wounds. Overall, the conflicted portrayal of the Phantom provides an allegory for the patriarchy in crisis. He is crafted as a man who wishes to run things behind the scenes, terrorizing people if his privilege goes unacknowledged, and wishfully believing that the woman he controls will be seduced by his power, while also affecting moments of tenderness, but only if these means will help him achieve his ends. The union he desires, then, will perhaps make him whole, likely in part because it will affirm the completeness of his masculinity. In the 19th century, the traditional narrative that did this kind of cultural work was the Bildungsroman, in which a young man grappled successfully with an obstacle to confirm his manhood. With Christine's rejection of him at the end, however, this confirmation of masculinity is imperiled. Yet Lloyd Webber seems to want to make the Phantom a sympathetic figure, and to do that, his hero cannot be thoroughly reprehensible. The figure of the long-suffering artist provides a perfect refuge for the misunderstood male protagonist. The Phantom is often referred to by other characters as the unseen genius. This is Christine when she explains to her friend Meg who her music tutor is, an angel of music. The opera house's ballet mistress, Madame Giry, explains to Raoul too that the Phantom is a genius. He's an architect and designer. He's a composer and a musician, a genius, monsieur. Raoul responds that clearly genius has turned to madness. In both instances, the women use the term genius to explain away the Phantom's eccentric behavior. The retreat of this character into a romantic genius stereotype is not altogether surprising, and it makes sense historically. As Christine Battersby has shown in her book on gender and genius, the 19th century model of genius turned away from at least two centuries of defining masculinity against femininity. Instead, romantic genius combined them in a complicated alchemy. Men of genius might have aspects considered feminine, but it did not make these men effeminate as long as these traits were understood to be in the service of creatively productive activities. Women who exhibited such traits as fiery tempers or fits of melancholy, however, continued to exemplify long-standing beliefs about the female sex's particular susceptibility to mental illness, brought about by the ancient belief that the womb wandered throughout the body, making women prone to hysteria. So men could take on some of these excessive qualities without any detriment to their character. It makes sense that the synthesis between masculine and feminine traits might return in the 1980s, at a point when some men may have been considering embracing a new masculinity as a result of second wave feminist critique, but who simultaneously feared the feminization of American men. The romantic genius archetype offered a synthesis of gendered behaviors with little risk to man's overall masculinity. Furthermore, the Phantom exists in a long line of masculine genius types whose creative project was to design ideal women, particularly by making them docile through music. In stories such as these, the focus of man's creative energies is often to control a woman's potentially powerful singing voice. The fears about woman's song is centuries old, dating at least as far back as the myth of the sirens, whose voices lured sailors to their deaths. In the 19th century, however, men had reason to fear that women were encroaching on the monopoly of creative gifts. These concerns were related to the growing cultural power of operatic prima donnas. Thus, when a story portrays a male genius attempting to control a woman's voice, we might understand it as an allegory for men trying to regulate the cultural power of female performers. E.T.A. Hoffman attempts to reverse the unbridled power of women and their voices in his story Radkrispel and Johannes Kreisler's Certificate of Apprenticeship. You may know them as the Tales of Hoffman. The male artists manage women's music, manipulating women as if they were instruments. And this is actually not too far off from a description of My Fair Lady either. Hoffman's tales attempt to reverse the traditional narrative about women's song destroying men by showing that men create the music that women perform, and therefore the men are no longer threatened by women's musical utterances. In these cases, music becomes masculinized because most composers were male out of social practice, but also because since the late 18th century, only men were thought to possess genius, that is, capable of writing, performing, and conducting serious music, while women were relegated in general to amateur parlor music. In this paradigm, woman's talent or genius might destroy her, or if used in the service of a male composer's gift, the woman is stripped of talent to become the less threatening figure of the empty vessel that brings a man's music to life. Despite several stories that strip women of musical agency, they often conclude that men's attempts to control women's voices are futile. While a male artist might fashion himself as Pygmalion, fully in control of his ideal woman, such men in 19th century tales often end up the protagonist in one of Ovid's other vignettes, Vulcan, the man who made the infamous Pandora. In this story, the blacksmith designed a woman out of clay, but rather than being the perfect woman, she is perceived to be the evil counterpart to man. In later stories, she is characterized by violence, rebellion, flirtatiousness, or simply little desire for domestic life. In the 19th century, many of the stories about designing women end in failure. Olympia, from Jacques Offenbach's opera Le Comte d'Hoffmann, is one example of the empty vessel, who threatens to become unruly and must ultimately be destroyed. The scientists Spallanzani and Coppelius have invented a mechanical doll that sings. The title character falls in love with her because her creators make him wear magic glasses that make her appear as a real woman. As Hoffmann whirls around dancing with Olympia, his glasses fall off, and he realizes that he's been tricked, and Coppelius destroys the automaton in a fit of rage. Although she is the archetypal male fantasy of a woman totally created and controlled by men, Olympia ultimately represents man's failure to create the ideal woman. She first appears as a manageable instrument, whose aria Les oiseaux dans la chermille is drained of its own expressive content. She is literally objectified here, and her makers are understood to have all the power. The effect of this aria is to efface the presence of the female performer. But because it's a coloratura showpiece, it is in reality difficult to ignore the performer. And this encapsulates the tension of the opera. Olympia as a robot can be seen as an instrument who self-destructs because while she is a machine, she's still a woman. She begins as the construction of the perfect, docile femininity, but then reveals her gender's volatility and temptation to fall apart. Her undoing may furthermore be related to the needs of the real singer who performed the role, Adele Isaac, and she required an aria that showed off her voice's flexibility. Therefore, to preserve the masculine control both on stage and off, Olympia must be destroyed and is at the end of the scene.
Ritorno.
most of the time when I show videos like this, I want to include English subtitles, but it really doesn't matter what she says. And that's why we objectify her. She's just an object that does tricks. And that's how we should understand her. The relationship between such 19th century narratives and Phantom of the Opera is easy to see. The Phantom attempts to create a docile female subject by controlling her voice, but she, like 19th century female characters before her, is ultimately rebellious. In the end, she marries Raoul rather than the Phantom. If women's growing cultural power in the musical realm inspired these romantic stories like this one, the late 20th century was likewise a moment in which some men began to fear that women were wresting power away from them, and so a story about a man controlling a woman's voice seems perfectly apt. Ultimately, my concern with this show is how even though the Phantom attempts to control the heroine and even murder several characters who question his power, we are still asked to sympathize with him. Why are we asked to feel sorry for him? Are we supposed to weep for the decline of traditional masculinity? Is it simultaneously designed to reveal the impotence of an older archetype of masculine power, one that's tied to the domination of women? A few aspects of the plot and characters can provide insight into how we might interpret the cultural work of this musical. First, the Phantom's construction as 19th century genius provides refuge for his otherwise eccentric behavior. His passionate outbursts and emotional volatility can be explained away by his associations with musical creativity. But for the audience to feel real sympathy for him, he has to be shown as a legitimate rival for Christine's love, not just a violent, disfigured man who lusts after the heroine. In the 2004 film, we are given insight into the Phantom's private life, which is designed to inspire the audience to pity his cruel fate. The Opera House's choreographer, Madame Giry, recounts the Phantom's tragic childhood. She explains that the young Phantom was part of a traveling band of gypsies. As part of the circus's freak show, the young disfigured boy was displayed as, quote, the devil's child. He was whipped and then his face exposed to mocking crowds. He eventually kills his master and flees with the help of a young Giry. Thus, the Phantom's desperate need for love relates to his sad past. This sets up the context in which we might understand the love triangle between Christine and her two suitors. While in the aftermath of second wave feminism, it may seem clear that the Count offers a better mate for the heroine in numerous ways. Indeed, he is more clearly the new man of the 1980s. He is young, attractive, wealthy, and proud of her musical successes. He has no desire to control her or ask her to give up her career. The Phantom, on the other hand, is possessive and scarred physically and emotionally. The two men's differences can be read through the language they use to speak with Christine. In the Phantom's Music of the Night, he asks her to embrace darkness and her darker side, whereas Raoul uses opposite metaphors of light in All I Ask of You. Furthermore, unlike Music of the Night, Christine has an equal role to play in the duet as the lovers exchange music. In her duet with the Phantom, Christine doesn't play an equal role, and the Phantom seems to control her words. Unlike the Phantom's rhetoric of possessiveness, Raoul asks that wherever she goes, he go too.
Nighttime sharpens, heightens each sensation.
And notice how, in this film especially, she seems so, like, supernaturally drawn to him, as if she's, like, under his spell.
Silently the senses abandon their defenses. Its splendor, grasp it, sense it, tremulous and tender. Turn your face away from the garish light of day. Turn your thoughts away from cold, unfeeling light. And listen to the music of the night. Close your eyes and surrender to your darkest dreams. Purge your thoughts of the life you knew before.
So you see, he uses all this rhetoric of darkness, and he says, give up the life you knew before, which is pretty stalkerish. So I don't know, maybe that doesn't bother everyone, but... In the next one, what we notice in this is an equal exchange. So rather than him just, like, the phantom kind of monologues at her and tells her to give up her life and everything she knew before, literally that's what he says, right? Here we have this equal exchange, and so this seems more like the progressive romantic hero that we've been longing for.
Forget these wide-eyed fears. I'm here. Nothing can harm you. My words will warm and calm you. Let me be your freedom. Let daylight dry your tears. I'm here with you, beside you, to guard you and to guide you. Anywhere you go, let me know.
Yet the musical doesn't make clear that Christine should end up with Raoul. Though all I ask of you, throughout, the Phantom broods in the shadows. He complains, I gave you my music, made your song take wing, and how you repaid me, denied me, and betrayed me. That's what he says at the end of his scene. He cries over his loss, and we hear this offstage reprise. Moments such as these remind us of his pain and seek to arouse our pity. Despite my modern feminist sensibility and my investigation of the tactics of the author, the composer, and film director to manipulate our sympathy for the title character, I still find myself feeling sorry for the Phantom at the end of this particular film, and it troubles me. How does the Phantom stalk our heroine, coerce her into a relationship by threatening the death of the man that she loves, and murder people and still inspire our compassion in the end? Why do we buy into the tragic vision of the romantic genius? Is it his disformity that makes us uncomfortable with shunning him? Is it his depiction as a suffering child that awakens our pity? I don't yet have answers to these questions, but the Phantom, like other heroes emerging out of the 1980s, seems to thrive on being tragically marginalized, and it is through pity that they provoke our admiration. So while in the original mythology, Echo loses agency and fades away to a whisper and a memory, when the Phantom seems to be reduced to an echo at the end of a tale, it leaves a lasting impression and seems to be just as manipulative as the Phantom himself, preying as it does on our sympathies because it asks us to feel sorry for the title character in such a way that even feminists such as myself become complicit in hoping that his social and cultural privileges are somehow restored. Indeed, I think the cultural work of this show hinges on gaining women's pity so that it is neither Christine nor the Phantom that must be made over, but we modern women who longed for progressive heroes, seeking sympathy indeed. Thank you. Thank you. I will take questions if you have any. Don't be shy. Comments too, you don't have to ask a question. People, students especially, are always afraid to ask a question because they're like, maybe she said it in there and then I'm gonna look dumb. Don't worry about it. Yes, Katie. Yeah, it's always a question. So I teach a lot of these issues in my classes. So while my research is devoted primarily to gender and sexuality in class, I deal with issues of race and able-bodiedness and all kinds of other stuff in class. And we sometimes see these historical works that are like, ooh, gosh, that's really sketchy with regard to race or whatever. And so what do we do with them? Are we supposed to disavow them now? And that's at least... In my classes, that's not what I'm asking students to do. I want them to kind of see and be critical of historical texts and to say, okay, that's there, because it teaches us something about ourselves and our kind of cultural heritage. I do think that if we want to perform them, it is nice to have some scaffolding. So it's not like, hey, we all believe that, you know, like, for example, in Mozart's Magic Flute. I think a lot of us really like that show. But there's a moment where Monostatos says, I am ugly because I am black. Okay, so that's uncomfortable, right? So I think we do need to talk about that, but we can do it in such a way that we continue to preserve these cultural works, but we don't have to necessarily continue to transmit their values. I think, in fact, what's great about some of these works is they make people uncomfortable, right? So these really racist or really sexist works, when they make us uncomfortable, it asks us to think. And that's a good thing. So I don't think that we should kind of disavow them and not perform them, but I do think it is worth a conversation or some sort of scaffolding, either with a pre-concert talk or program notes or whatever. Yeah, it's a good question. Yes?
You spoke a lot about social structures of the 80s and
yes.
how that helped bring about this musical. I was wondering if you could talk about political structures and
yes.
political climates, because I'm struck by how the musical came out in
86 and then 88 in the States.
And the film version came out in 2005 or 6.
Four, yeah.
Okay, so again, these are two moments where there are rises of the political right, and I'm just struck by that randomness.
Yeah, so... what I know about that is Susan Jeffords has a book called Hard Bodies, and it's about the sort of relationship between like Terminator and RoboCop and Reagan, and how he actually styled himself. He kept kind of referring to himself as like a Rambo, which is highly amusing. But he basically wanted to get away from like Nixon and all these other things, these presidents that were perceived to be feminized, and so he was constructing himself as this cowboy, which is interesting because after 9/11 we also have a president who constructs himself as a cowboy, and we have this critique. Basically, if you've read or if you're interested in these issues, reading Susan Faludi's book *The Terror Dream* talks about how there were parts of the political right that blamed 9/11 on women working. It's really weird how they got there, but they did. And so it's not surprising that we have this at these two moments where we perceive to have this feminization of culture, that we have a rise of masculine heroes. So I think there is plenty of cultural work that suggests that, in fact, those two moments, like the moment in the 19th century, is a point of crisis. Now, but you can always argue that masculinity is in crisis because, you know, if you've got power, you always assume that there are barbarians at the gate, right? So any kind of privilege is always assumed to be in crisis because you have to continue to shore up that power. But there do seem to be some political resonances at each of these moments that I think tie it together nicely, yeah. Other questions, comments, ideas? I'm still looking for two more chapters, so you know, if you've got some ideas. Yeah, Sam.
Well, did you do much study with the instrumentation that was associated with each voice and like how it was like the instrumental conversation like correlated to what we're supposed to feel for the characters?
It's a great question, and I think a lot of it plays upon, you know, like the soaring "All I Ask of You." I mean, it's very manipulative. I actually look at it more with My Fair Lady, because in My Fair Lady, Lerner and Lowe really wanted Henry Higgins and Eliza to get together. But if you know that show, they really shouldn't get together. She's like 18, he's kind of old, he's kind of not very, well, he's not nice. And so why are we asked to want them together? Well, nothing in the show suggests that they should get together. There's no love song. Her big song, "I Could Have Danced All Night," has this feeling of a love song, but she's not in love with Henry Higgins. She's really excited that she finally said, "The rain in Spain stays mainly on the plane," successfully. But it sounds like a love song. And so in these moments where he's about to take her to the embassy ball and he offers her his arm and they sort of go off together to the ball, we hear a reprise of I could have danced all night, and we're supposed to hear that as romantic music. And then at the end, even though there's no hug, there's no kiss, there's no traditional love story there, it swells again in the orchestra, basically manipulating us into thinking they should get together. So there are many points in these musicals that I feel like music does a lot of interesting work. In this one, I think what I'll probably explore is the Phantom's theme, which is this like Baroque style organ theme that I think is actually related to the rise of heavy metal, which also took on Baroque themes. So if you know the history of heavy metal, most of the guitarists and organists, because there were organists in heavy metal, practiced Bach and Vivaldi and Pachelbel and dedicated their albums to Baroque masters. So that to me seems interesting, that this virtuosity is going to be tied to a kind of masculinity, which of course it is in heavy metal. So when you have, like, what happens is, and those of you have taken some of my classes, you know that the male voice soars really high, and then when it reaches its, sort of the breaking point for the voice, the guitar comes in and finishes out the phrase. And so I think that the music here is probably shoring up a kind of a masculinity based on kind of heavy metal tropes, but I haven't explored that yet fully, but that's where I think I'm going with that. Yeah. Yes, so this is kind of what I'm struck by. But I think sympathy hasn't always been the way of getting us to want him to continue to have power. That's why I'm struck by this one, because it really seems to be playing on women's need to sympathize with this character. So actually transforming these second wave feminists who are like, you know, down with male power to being like, ooh, maybe, you know, he's disfigured and that seems wrong and whatever. So I think it's actually, I think it's preying upon women, which is both exciting as a researcher, but also sad as a feminist. That, like, I've just bought in, you know? I'm like, oh yes, restore all his power. That's what kind of sketches me out a little bit about this. It's a really good question.
What kind of trends do you notice among the composers or librettists of these works? Like, what kind of trends do you notice in their maybe early personal lives or something like that?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. I mean, we always kind of want to know, like, is this because, you know, they experience loved lost or something like that. I think we'll never really know that. It's something that, at least in my classes, I teach as the intentional fallacy, that we can't ever really know what these writers or composers were thinking. We can't ever really get back to that, unfortunately, because most composers didn't go, dear diary, on page 2, when I wrote that thing, this is what I was feeling. And if they did, then we would be all set. But they don't do that. And so I think most of what our job as researchers is to do is to figure out why this was so enormously popular for so long. Like, it made more money than the film Titanic, you know, which was huge. It's been the longest running musical. And so it clearly appeals to our sensibilities somehow, and that we might be able to recover. But whether or not this is about the librettist or the composer, I think it's just hard to know. But people do speculate, and it sometimes is comforting to be like, okay, this might be a personal story rather than a larger cultural narrative. But I think the fact that it's so popular, it in fact is a larger cultural narrative, which is why we should probably take a look at it. Yeah, Jacob, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I did.
And now you're like, nope. Yeah. Yeah, so we wonder then, like with Raoul, like should we like him because he represents sort of the aristocracy and you know, the Phantom, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what his class is. You know, he was part of this band of gypsies apparently. But then he kind of circulates, he lives in an opera house and he's always wearing a tux, you know? So like the class things are slightly confusing there. Certainly I think there is this Cinderella imagery with, Christine going from the slave girl in the show to like wearing the big white dress. I suspect there are probably some class issues, but at least in America in the 1980s, we imagined ourselves as a classless society. And only then were we starting to think a little bit about class. So the inflections of class seem to be less resonant in this show, but are really important, I think, to My Fair Lady. Because in a lot of makeover films, especially with women, we see women going from like big hair, and often curly hair, unruly, to like straight hair and like perfectly done makeup and things like that. And those are class signifiers, even in America, where we pretend that we're a classless society. So I do think there are some there, but they just would have been less patently obvious to audiences because we were imagining ourselves as classless. So I think they're there. And they're far more palpable in the 19th century novel than they are in the musical, I think. Yeah. Yeah, so they're starting to do that. So there's a performance of the very, very sketchy musical, The Mikado, right? Ooh, race, and that now we're having Asian performers perform those roles instead of white people in yellow face, because, you know, yuck. So we're starting to see that, but not with Phantom. And I read some reviews of a local production in Worcester, Massachusetts, decided to hire an African-American performer to play the Phantom for the first time. The problem was he was like, this role is sexy and manly. And I'm like, ah, OK. So like, it didn't problematize the role at all. So I've yet to see anything that's, I mean, actually, and there's no musicological work on this musical that is saying like what this musical does. It's all like, people just thought Lloyd Webber was a hack, but look at some cool stuff that he does. So there's yet to be much criticism actually on this particular musical. There's a lot of criticism of other musicals, but really it's like low-hanging fruit. Like there are, you know, plenty of criticisms of musicals like The Mikado or whatever that are just so patently racist that, or, you know, Miss Saigon or The King and I or things like that where you just really can't ignore the fraught nature of it. This one seems to kind of just slip under the radar like it's not problematic at all. So, but there is a movement to do this with musicals, so I anticipate that will happen. With Grease, I always get nervous because we perform that at so many high schools, and I'm like, gang violence, abortion, teen pregnancy, anybody? And they're just like, nope, no problem. Okay. So we're slowly moving towards critical production, but it is very slow. Yeah, Charlotte.
How would you think, or let's say, that the least problematic musical would be at this?
That's a really great question, and one I can't answer, because the reason I started working on musicals was because they scare me. I'm always like, oh no, what is happening? So I wish I could say that I began as a lover of musicals, but in fact, the reason I'm working on musicals is because I find them so tragic in their depictions of people. And I know lots of people love musicals, and there's nothing wrong with that. I love problematic music too. But the reason that I'm drawn to this project is to say, look at this problem. Can we talk about this? So it's from that perspective that I'm writing this book. So I would have to ask you to talk to someone who, you know, grew up loving musicals instead of me. Yeah, Bronwyn. Yep. Yep. Yes, and there's just opera after opera after opera, beginning, I think, with Rinaldo in 1711, Armide, that story didn't have two female characters originally. It only had Armide, and Handel and his librettist invented Almirena so that we could have a good example of feminine virtue. And from that moment on, most of the operas where we have an ambitious woman, it has to have the feminine foil. And so from that moment on in opera, we always have one that exemplifies virtue and one that doesn't. And it's just, it, I mean, it's Lloyd Webber knows his opera, and so he's really building on those tropes, and I think also playing on the fact that he was perceived as a hack and too popular, even though, I mean, he's got references to Meyerbeer and all kinds of other stuff in here that, you know, if you're just a layperson, you don't know, but he really knows his stuff, and so he's playing on those things for sure. Okay, well, I've taken up a lot of your time, so if you have other questions, feel free to come up, ask me questions, comments, whatever, but you should all go do other things.